Max Bergman here. For more of the Asset Podcast, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/assetpodcast. That's patreon.com/assetpodcast. You'll hear the full interviews with our roster of experts and analysts. You'll also get more exclusive content from the Asset team, like our interview with the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, our live event reacting to Robert Mueller's testimony, an upcoming episode following the mysterious trail of dead Russians around the 2016 election, and a whole lot more. Don't miss out. Sign up today at www.patreon.com/assetpodcast.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this bonus episode of The Asset. I'm Paul Woodhull. I'm the president of District Productive. That's the podcast company that partnered with the Center for American Progress Action Fund and Protect the Investigation to produce The Asset. Today, I'm going to be sitting down with Max Bergman, the host of The Asset and the executive director of the Moscow Project, to talk about the 2020 presidential election, the surprises we saw there, the lack of interference from Russia, and what is happening now in the days leading up to the inauguration. If you'd like to learn more about the transition from President Trump to President-elect Joseph Biden and all of the landmines that are littering the political landscape, I would like to recommend that you subscribe, rate, and review to our new podcast called Unconventional Threat. In the Unconventional Threat podcast, we look at the 2020 election year, which was unlike any other in ways that are unsettling and dangerous. Based on hard reporting, facts, and constitutional law, the podcast was intended to prepare you for very possible unconventional threats. And we saw several of those threats become reality. We also talk about the ways we can come together as a nation to ensure that everyone has the chance to vote, their votes are counted, and the count is respected to create our national choice for president. You can find us on all your favorite podcast apps or go to unconventionalthreat.com. Unconventional Threat is produced by District Productive, and it's in partnership with Keep Our Republic. For more information, you can also go to keepourrepublic.com. That's keepourrepublic.com. And now, here's my conversation with Max Bergman. Max, how you doing?
Doing well, Woody. Thanks. How are you?
World is burning, but I'm okay. So, I really wanted to talk with you first and foremost about, you know, topic A for The Asset, which is Russian interference in the presidential election. So, what happened this time? We were all expecting, a major offensive by the Russian intelligence service and services, and I don't think it happened.
Yeah, no, I think you could argue that Russian interference in 2020 was sort of the dog that didn't bark. I think there's some clear evidence that Russia was interfering in the election. We'll talk about Ukraine and the whole Rudy Giuliani escapade later. And that clearly is connected to Russian intelligence. There are clearly efforts by Russia online in the information space, the disinformation space, so that we saw Russia interfering. But we didn't get the big bomb, the big explosion, the big effort that we expected. And I think what this reflects is that the big thing that was in 2016 wasn't really so much the disinformation, but it was the leak of John Podesta's emails. That was sort of the big thing.
Well, what big leak? What were you expecting, or did you have a clue about what the bomb was that they were going to explode?
Yeah, I think what people were expecting was something similar to 2016, where you had John Podesta's emails, you had a hack of the Democratic Party before the convention, and all of that was just put out into public view. And, you know, this time there was a lot of fear that since we're all virtual, since every meeting is now online through Zoom or Teams or Google Meet or whatever platform the Biden campaign was using, and everyone's texting, everyone's calling, everyone's emailing, there's, you know, people aren't chatting in person the same way they used to, that there was lots of potential targets for Russian hackers, and that the Russians would hack and they would gain information that would be damaging to the Biden campaign, helpful to Trump, and that would leak and come out right before the election. It would be this October surprise that we saw in 2016. Remember, October 7th was the day that the Access Hollywood tape came out, and then 29 minutes later, that's when Podesta's emails dropped. And that's what people were, I think, expecting this time around. Now, there's a number of potential reasons why that didn't materialize, and maybe we'll just tick through some of them. You know, one, the Russians in some ways got lucky the last time, that it was, is particularly in Podesta's emails, that Podesta was told a poor cybersecurity expert that was working with a campaign wrote a word incorrectly, meant to say don't click on it, instead wrote it's fine, click on it. And so Podesta clicked on the spear phishing link. And so maybe the Russians just didn't get lucky and didn't get that kind of access. Another explanation is that they did, but that there wasn't anything damaging. They never really found anything that was going to be particularly newsworthy or noteworthy. And then I think there's another explanation, which is that they did have information. They definitely probably hacked some people. They probably found some things that maybe could be disparaging, could be distracting. But either they didn't quite have the same venue to distribute that information. WikiLeaks was this sort of godsend, right? You had this this journalistic looking outfit that was seen as leftist and progressive. That's how WikiLeaks was perceived in 2016. That you could effectively launder the information out into the public. It would be seen as leaks. And they didn't quite have that. You know, there, yes, there was OANN, which they tried to leak some information about Ukraine in the 2020 election, but you didn't quite have the same venue that you had, the same sort of neutral seeming vehicle that WikiLeaks provided. And then I think a fourth reason, a fourth reason is that the Russians could read the polls. Now, the polls happen to be wrong, but, you know, they have a guy in Konstantin Kilimnik who is a savvy political operator who was trained by Paul Manafort. This is what we talked about in our recent epilogue episode based on the Senate Intelligence Committee report. And Kilimnik is a very astute American political observer. He was the point person in 2016 for the Russians. And, you know, I think it's likely that the Trump campaign didn't kind of have a Paul Manafort to act as a go-between in the same way that Manafort served in 2016. And so Kilimnik's looking at the polling. Maybe he got some internal polling. Maybe he didn't. But the polling for everybody, for Democrats and Republicans, internal polls or not internal polls, looked like it was going to be a bloodbath for the president, and looked like Trump had basically no shot at winning the election.
But didn't it look similarly last time, 4 years ago? And wasn't that the reason why they were so aggressively interfered into the election?
So that's a great question. I think, and this is why we break down the August 2nd meeting in 2016 between Kilimnik and Manafort so extensively in the epilogue episode, because my read on Russian actions were that after the DNC leak in 2016, and that's in the summer in July, then there's about an intervening week, you know, everything went south for Trump. He got in a fight with a Gold Star father. The polling numbers looked brutal. And so Kilimnik arrives in New York, ostensibly maybe to talk about Viktor Yanukovych and Ukraine, but really to get a briefing from Manafort on the election about how they could win. And Manafort had this strategy and had this polling data to demonstrate how they could win this election. And so Manafort, I think at that August 2nd meeting, convinced Kilimnik that it was possible. And my guess is in August, you have this internal discussion within the Kremlin about whether Trump is a lost cause or not. And Manafort had given one side of that debate a lot of ammunition, saying that, no, Trump has a way to win, and Manafort sort of outlined it. I also would point to, if you were just reading the 538, you know, blogs and Nate Cohn at the New York Times, you know, 2016, there were glimmers of hope for Trump, in which I think people like me just ignored because it didn't seem possible that we could elect this guy. This time around, you know, you looked at all the modeling and they were all showing, no, there's no hope. And in fact, a lot of the internal congressional polls, which in 2016 were sort of blinking red for Clinton, were showing incredibly positive news for Democratic House candidates. Now, those polls ended up being very wrong in 2020. But I think all the data, literally all the data that we had this time around, looked pretty clear that Trump was not going to win. I think that data was right, but it looked like it was not going to be close. I think it's a fair question to say, well, you know, wouldn't they want to go back in? I think another aspect here is that we were prepared, that this was, you know, after 4 years of groups like the Moscow Project, of podcasts like The Asset, of Congress spending hundreds of millions of dollars belatedly, and it wasn't quite enough trying to get it through Mitch McConnell, but money was spent. States were aware. We had the Department of Homeland Security, and Chris Krebs was leading a cyber infrastructure response that was strong. The National Security Agency was leading, you know, actually very aggressive assaults on cyber hackers and cyber attackers. So the same thing that we thought could happen in 2016, you know, we were more aware. There was more public awareness. There was more government awareness. And so I think it became a lot harder for the Russians to do this play again.
So you mentioned that the United States played offense before the election, attacking Russian intelligence, cyber intelligence operations. What form did that take, and how did it prevent Russia from being more aggressive leading up to the election and on election day itself?
So this is a great question. The New York Times, David Sanger, who's sort of the preeminent journalist when it comes to, I think, cybersecurity, you know, basically he did an interview with the head of the NSA and with Chris Krebs. And there was a degree of spiking the football where they credited essentially their efforts. And I think they do deserve a lot of credit. I think it's hard to sort of know for sure, but the NSA was clearly much more forward leaning. You know, 2 years ago, there was actually the NSA got, you know, there's something called a delegation of authority in government where, you know, normally any sort of offensive cyber action would require sort of the sign off of the president. And what the NSA was able to do was sort of slip a paper, you know, up through the process and say, hey, Mr. President, please sign this. It just allows us to do more cybersecurity stuff. And the president signed it, which essentially gave the NSA and Cybercom the ability to do more aggressive action. And so on election day of 2018, they actually, you know, turned off the internet for the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. And this is the troll farm in Russia. And we know that there was a lot of aggressive activity targeting various amounts of cyber hackers and other sort of cyber groups in the lead up to the election. The one thing I will, you know, I think it's important to note here is a lot of the cyber criminals, there's a huge portion of them that are based out of Russia. And these are sort of private actors. They're effectively pirates. And the way they work is that the Russian state, the Kremlin, has effectively given them a safe haven, not dissimilar to how the Taliban gave Al-Qaeda a safe haven. And they can operate and they can do their things and steal their money and do whatever they're doing. But then every once in a while, they need to sort of, the state will call in a favor and they'll have to do it. It looks like, you know, the U.S. was really alert to that, was paying close attention, was responding rather aggressively. So maybe that upset some of Russia's offensive cyber intentions. I also think we hardened the target. And this is where Chris Krebs deserves a lot of credit. You know, 4 years ago, the thing we have to remember is state and local election officials, the people who operate our elections, you know, they were just as blind to the notion of foreign interference as anyone else. Over the last 4 years, they've heard nothing but that. I was on a conference call once with a colleague of mine at the center at the Council on Foreign Relations to talk about the potential Russian threat in the 2020 election with state and local election officials, secretaries of state. And, you know, the reaction was, we get it. we're not blind to this. And that was, I think, a largely bipartisan sense. And I think where Krebs deserves a lot of credit is while, you know, a voice like mine that clearly comes from the progressive side of the aisle, you know, may not convince the Georgia Secretary of State, someone like Krebs from the Trump administration can really have that effect. And so I think there are a lot of money was spent on cybersecurity, which hardened the target, made it harder to do the sort of hacking that we know was possible. And we know that the Obama administration was super concerned about in 2016.
So Chris Krebs and others do a great job protecting and securing the 2020 presidential election. And you're giving him credit. What did the Trump administration do?
So, you know, of course, Chris Krebs has now become famous because Trump fired him by tweet, because part of what Krebs was concerned about in particular was disinformation around the election. And so his organization had a website where they would publish sort of here's some fake disinformation out there about the election system. One thing they were concerned about is perhaps there would be sort of a Russian viral attack where it said all polling places are closed in Philadelphia, so that people then wouldn't show up to vote and it would appear in everyone's Facebook feed. And so that's what they were focused on. But it turned out, you know, we don't really need the Russians to do disinformation anymore. We have President Trump. And so a lot of what they were combating was stuff coming from Trump. And that Trump became aware of that and fired Krebs and his deputy resigned. But the fortunate thing is the number three in his organization is a career civil servant that he hand selected and can't be fired by the president at least as easily as Krebs and others because they're political appointees.
You know, it should also be noted, though, when we're talking about disinformation, one of the lessons that the Russians learned in 2016 is that it's so much more effective for them to take homegrown American-made disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, and those three things are different, and then amplify it rather than to try to create their own disinformation. And that was one of the lessons that they learned in their previous attempt.
That's right. And we were so susceptible to it, right? We in 2016, there's a tweet that I'm fond of reciting. I think I did it in the first season, but from a former Colbert show writer, Daniel Kibblesmith, who it's something like this. It basically goes, in 1996, your mom says, don't trust anything on the internet. In 2016, your mom says, did you know Hillary Clinton invented AIDS, according to facebook.newyorktimes.fake.net? And I think that is a really reflective tweet of where we were in 2016, where we were in 96. We trusted the internet. We didn't conceive that the internet, that Twitter or Facebook, that we would be getting lies and disinformation. And now I think that's been internalized by the public and also been weaponized by, you know, definitely parts of the far right that view disinformation as a key political tactic. And so it's sort of, you know, the Russians now, I think, can go back to doing what the traditional Russian active measures were about. We're about identifying, and this is in many ways what they did in 2016, but identifying weaknesses in our internal politics, internal culture, and looking to sort of amplify them. Maybe it's trying to, you know, host a rally or a protest where you invite white nationalist groups and Black Lives Matter groups, and you hope violence occurs, right? And that's something that we sort of saw in 2016. But you can focus on these sort of niche, sort of more intel operation efforts rather than trying to sort of create mass swings in public opinion. So I think the disinformation space was a bit harder for Russia this time around. But I think a large part of that is the work that a lot of groups have done, highlighting the threat of Russian disinformation, and then just highlighting the Russian threat in general. It meant that they had to be a lot more careful in how they operated. I mean, just think back, you know, in the Mueller report, the head of the Internet Research Agency, this Russian oligarch, sent, you know, he had two of his people go and take a picture out in front of the White House, or he didn't have them. They voluntarily did this, took a picture in front of the White House, basically wishing him happy birthday in May before the election. You know, there was sort of a brazen assault where they knew that the Americans weren't really onto them at all. And now they couldn't operate that way. They didn't have the same freedom of movement. And so I think you add that all together, the sense that Trump was definitely doomed this time, I think, was rather significant. The greater awareness amongst our government actors, both state, local, and federal, and, you know, the press and the NGOs and others being much more attuned to the potential threat of Russian interference.
In the same way, the Asset pulled back the curtain on the full story of Trump's ties to Russia, Made to Fail pulls back the curtain on how conservative policies across the country set up millions of Americans for failure in the face of a crisis like today's pandemic. If you like the rich details and in-the-weeds analysis of the Asset, you'll enjoy this new podcast as it takes you state by state to tell the story of how conservative ideology has gutted the safety net, corrupted our institutions, and made government unaccountable. To get the full backstory of how we got here and how we find a way out, listen to Made to Fail. The first episode, which we're sharing today, explores how conservatives forced Wisconsin to hold an in-person election at the height of a pandemic. Take a listen and subscribe to Made to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
So there was one unique aspect of the 2020 campaign that was an attempt to result in Trump victory, and that was the Ukraine operation. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think in retrospect, it's amazing that this might have actually worked, because the election, you know, while it's decisive, you know, you can narrow this down to three states and 45,000 votes, where if those 45,000 votes had swung the other way, much the way 77,000 votes decided 2016, Trump would be reelected. And with that small margin, the whole Hunter Biden Ukraine pseudo scandal could have definitely had a major impact on the election. And pseudo, i.e., it's a fake scandal. And I think the reason why it would have had, you know, if we sort of just, you know, delete all we know about this, and if impeachment had never happened, if that whistleblower in August of 2019, you know, that feels like 10 years ago, but if that whistleblower hadn't come forward and said, basically, Trump tried to, you know, extort the Ukrainian president to get him to do a political hit on Biden, if that hadn't happened and we were sort of living in the dark, and suddenly in October, there's, you know, an allegation that's emerged, a laptop that's emerged that showed that Hunter Biden coordinated with his father, whatever the actual, you know, tenets of the scandal, coordinated with his father to basically get rich or to get rich and extort Ukraine. It would have been, I think, something the press would have looked at, would have probably publicized a lot more, because they did publicize it, but they publicized it not in October. They publicized it back during the Ukraine scandal when Republicans to defend the president brought this out. So this wasn't intended to be really brought out in the midst of an impeachment scandal involving Trump. It was meant to be weaponized against Biden during the general election. And so what impeachment did is effectively forced the Trump crowd to bring forward Hunter Biden, the Hunter Biden charges and allegations, in which we've gone over endlessly. And the press looked at them. They thoroughly sort of assessed it. And then they said there was nothing there. So any effort to then sort of bring it back didn't really work. And I think it's worth noting that in you know, what ended up happening was that Rudy tried to keep getting Rudy Giuliani, the president's attorney, tried to keep getting new information that could potentially make this somewhat explosive. And so it's clear that he was working with a guy, Andrei Derkach, who's a Ukrainian politician who our U.S. intelligence community now says is tied to Russian intelligence. And he literally attended Russian spy school, that was getting information from him that he was then trying to leak to the press. Initially, he tried to provide it through the Homeland Security Committee and Ron Johnson. But then this famous New York Post story that where this weird laptop, which arrived from Hunter Biden at this computer repair shop in Delaware in April of 2019, What else happened in April 2019? Oh, there was the what was it called? Oh, yeah, the Mueller report came out. And so the Mueller report, you know, this was also part of an effort to distract from Mueller. And so they tried to have this big reveal happen. And the Post was the only outfit, New York Post, which is Rupert Murdoch Press, that was willing to sort of run with it. But even they weren't really willing to run with it because it was really confusing if anything on the laptop was actually, you know, Hunter Biden's, or whether it was just all Russian disinformation. We still don't know. But the end result here was that it just all seemed farcical because it just was a rehash of something that they had ginned up 2 years ago, that, or a year and a half ago, that we had all known about. And so I think the work of impeachment, without the work that was done, had a huge difference. It made a huge difference in this election, merely in the fact that it deprived Rudy and Trump of what was going to be their big October surprise, and meant that that never had any real impact. And there's a real alternative scenario where actually we spend all of October talking about Hunter Biden, even more than we talked about it this time, but the press takes it in a much more credulous way. But the whole point of the scandal was to pop the bubble of Biden's integrity, right? Is to try to demonstrate that Biden, no, he's actually just a corrupt politician, which is sort of what they were able to do with Hillary, and James Comey sort of miraculously played into that. But that was what the whole point of the scandal was. And the scandal in some ways gets you there if it were true, but it's not true. And so it doesn't get you there. And especially since the press has already discredited it.
So put on your political hat here, right? Of all the tactics that they could have used to discredit Biden, was this the one that people were going to get fired up about? I mean, when they attack Hillary Clinton, they were attacking Hillary Clinton. They weren't saying that her daughter did something. You know, it was like Clinton killed those people in Benghazi. Clinton, you're like, you know, is running a child molestation ring, whatever it is, you know, outlandish, crazy or not, they were sticking it on her. Was this the right tactic? Shouldn't they have been trying to tarnish Biden, not Biden's son?
Yeah, I think that's, well, here's what I would say. I think in 2016, there was a lot of luck involved in how Trump became president and how the attacks on Hillary and corrupt Hillary sort of all worked, because they had this ongoing email investigation that the FBI had for some insane reason decided to open. I mean, the opening of that whole investigation was absurd in and of itself, but the Trump folks had this actually legitimate FBI investigation going into Clinton. You also had 20 plus years of the press sort of assuming the worst about the Clintons, assuming every scandal was true, you know, and that goes back to, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for that, you know, the Clinton administration itself, but believing that a lot of the bad things about Hillary were true. And so with Comey, with the instincts of the press, it all sort of aligned to really denigrate Hillary Clinton. With Biden, the problem is that Biden, the press know, you know, the guy's been commuting via Amtrak for 40 years from Delaware. And despite Trump trying to say he lives in this lavish house, you know, it's not that Biden's poor, but compared to other senators, he doesn't have the same wealth that nearly any other senator has. He's a guy that's been a public servant for 40 years, and that's been his goal and objective, and the press know him, and they know him very well. So, you know, I think it was hard for the Trump folks to find a clean hit that could sort of resemble any sort of corruption vis-a-vis Biden. He also operated in one of the, you know, least scandal tainted administrations in American history, in the Obama administration. So I think they didn't have a lot to go with. But then here was Hunter, and there was something, you know, the fact that he was on the board of this Ukrainian company, you know, he was playing off his father's name. And there was, you know, and so that was a vulnerability. And the Biden campaign had a big New Yorker interview with Hunter Biden early on, recognizing that he needed to come clean about his past life, because that was all going to be an issue in the campaign. But so what they were going to try to do, and they could never quite, they could never do it because no one could ever get past the absurdity of the initial attack, was to say that Hunter was connected to Joe, that it wasn't just them working separately and Joe and Hunter just sort of taking advantage of his father's name. But no, Joe Biden was in on it. And there was never any proof. There was no evidence of that. They were just hoping they could insinuate that and that would be enough. So I think they just didn't have a strong hand to go with. You know, Biden's favorability ratings were much higher. So, you know, I think they were a little bit desperate. They didn't quite know what to do. They thought this was going to be a worthwhile attack, and they invested, you know, more than a, probably close to a year and a half of their time since, you know, basically January of 2019 into sort of trying to develop this attack on Biden. And this was, I think what they thought was that Russia was going to be a major line of attack for Democrats, that Trump colluded with Russia, and they were going to try to say Biden was corrupt and colluded with the Ukrainians. And that was going to be sort of how they countered the Russia collusion attacks. Now, it turned out Democrats didn't really talk about Russia collusion, didn't talk about really impeachment. But so, you know, I think there was some real logic put behind this attack, even if it was far less potent because it's so it's much more indirect and was not going to have the same same lethality, I think, that that the Clinton emails did. But the only reason why the Clinton emails became the thing, remember, was because James Comey made it happen. And I think it's also important to note that they were also hoping that Barr and others, Attorney General Barr, would sort of come to their rescue and do another sort of 11th hour Comey letter. And I think, you know, Barr didn't do it. And I don't think the reason was that Barr had any scruples. I just think that they, A, didn't have anything to go with. They were desperately trying to find some malfeasance related to the Russia investigation in the this is the so-called Durham investigation. They couldn't find any. And so at the end of the day, I think Barr realized he didn't have anything. And then Barr can also read polls and thought Trump was destined to lose. And there was sort of no point in doing this. It turned out there might have been a point in throwing something out there, but he didn't. And so, you know, in that sense, I think, you know, when I look at the vote totals, 45,000 votes, even if this was not going to be a clean hit on Joe Biden and wasn't going to, you know, replicate the Hillary emails scandal from October 2016, it still could have been enough if the press hadn't had given it more credulity. And I think they have to be given real credit, and also social media companies some credit too for taking down some of the content, not initially linking to the New York Post story. Now Twitter sort of says we regret, you know, doing that, but fine. But actually, I think what they did at the time was the right thing. And the press acted responsibly. They didn't run with the allegations. They wanted to make sure it was verified. This wasn't John Podesta's emails where reporters were running with stories about his risotto recipe or all these other, you know, really juicy bits of gossip that were in Podesta's emails. They showed some restraint here. And I think that is, you know, they were aware that this was, that there was going to be something like this. And they had learned, I think, some of the lessons that they hadn't from 2016. So I think the harping on what happened in 2016, I think mattered because it made us better prepared, more inoculated. Our antibodies were higher for combating the sort of, you know, fake information, disinformation, fake news that we saw coming out.
I remember sitting down and talking with a very, very smart gentleman about the margin of victory for Biden would be sort of lifting the turnout in all these states, which would pretty much make this a slam dunk. His name was Max Bergman. That was wrong. The entire election results had people who were hoping for a transition very, very scared for you know, for days, and it didn't. You know, the election was not as had been predicted. So let's talk about that just for a little bit. Like, more people voted for Donald Trump. Millions of people more voted for Donald Trump in 2020 than in 2016. And a lot of the people who voted for him in 2016 are dead.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a big lift in number of voters. How did nobody see that coming?
Well, so that's, I mean, it's a great question. And this is something that I think the political consulting class, the data gurus are going to have to really rip apart, because the polling was really wrong. And, you know, Nate Silver can say it wasn't that wrong. You know, it was wrong in a lot of places by a lot, which was enough that Democrats threw a ton of money in places where it was ridiculous. Now, in retrospect, totally absurd. We just, you know, Democrats flushed money down the toilet in places like Texas and other states.
Didn't that happen in 2016? Wasn't there a lesson to be learned?
Yeah. So in 2016, the polling was also wrong. And I think the major factor here, and I think what everyone needs to do, including yours truly, is to really reassess. I got a lot wrong. I think I got a number of things right. But I think, you know, the thing I had thought would happen was that Democrat turnout was just going to be so large. Republican turnout was just like not going to be that high. It was going to be what it always is. And that Democratic turnout was going to be, you know, enough to carry this election, that Biden was actually running a very smart race and in trying to make it all about Trump, and making it all about Trump would lead to a sort of cathartic rejection. And that didn't happen. You know, this whole last 4 years in some ways has been waiting for that moment of cathartic rejection and always sort of being disappointed. I think back to, you know, Mueller, you know, for 2 years, everyone was like, here it comes, or Trump is, you know, going to be nailed and then, you know, sort of sent away. And then the Mueller report comes out, or first the Barr letter, then the Mueller report, that Democrats don't really do anything. And it didn't never had this cathartic moment of, aha, he did it, we got him. And impeachment kind of was sort of like that. And then it quickly became clear that Republicans weren't going to break, and that, you know, while there might be hope for some defections, that it was going to be really hard to sort of, you know, for this, that cathartic moment just never materialized. And then it was like, okay, well, we're going to turn to this election, and that will be the cathartic rebuke of Donald Trump. And it turned out, no, there was no cathartic rebuke of Donald Trump. What happened was that Democratic turnout was exceptionally high. This was one of the highest turnout elections, I think, since 1900. Biden's share of the vote, you know, the number of votes he got is the most ever. Yet Trump increased his vote share. You know, if you look at Florida, for instance, 500,000 more people voted for Biden than they did for Hillary Clinton. That's great. The problem is 750,000 more people voted for Donald Trump. And while Florida was a lot more people voted for Trump than before, you know, we saw that throughout, that white rural turnout was exceptionally high for Donald Trump. And so when you think back on what should have been done differently, or was there anything to do differently over the last 4 years? Frankly, you know, Nate Cohn of the New York Times recently wrote a piece he wrote on Twitter that said, you know, Biden basically ran a more effective campaign than he basically ran the Clinton campaign again. He ran the 2016 campaign stronger together, but did it more effectively. He was more popular. They were more focused on the states they needed to win. And the Democratic base was more mobilized, and he won more suburban voters. And I think that's generally right. I think the problem is that when you look down ballot, when you look at the House and the Senate, and Democrats didn't do as well as Biden, and you can sort of argue, okay, well, what was the problem? And you see these fights that are happening now in the House between people like AOC, people like Conor Lamb. And I frankly think both sides have really good points. I think there were moments when progressives, and I would put myself in this, sometimes got over our skis and said and were saying things that actually just politically wouldn't wash. That we sort of, I think progressives got in their heads that nothing mattered, because look at Donald Trump. He would say all this crazy stuff and it never seemed to matter. So if it doesn't matter for him, why does it matter for us? And the basic blocking and tackling of politics of don't say unpopular things, you know, still applied. And it turned out that I think the Democratic brand had issues there. But I also think that the Democratic consulting class, which a lot of the moderates are sort of, you know, oh, just run on healthcare, just talk about healthcare. And yes, everyone cares about healthcare. But the problem is, and this is where I think everyone sort of got the consulting class really needs to take a look in the mirror, is when you force people to focus and you do a focus group and you say, okay, you know, like, does this healthcare message resonate for you? And you're like, yes, it does. It resonates more than this corruption message. And so what the consultants would say is, so just talk about healthcare. Because in this focus group where we're paying people literally to focus on what we're saying, they're like, well, yeah, when someone says they're against, you know, taking away, my healthcare, that resonates with me. I think that's true. And Democrats should include that in their messaging. However, no one's talking about healthcare right now. I mean, people are talking about the pandemic. I see Woody, your eyes go up like we're talking about healthcare. But Democrats aren't saying anything proactively about what they're going to do on healthcare. They're just saying we're going to prevent the other side from taking something away, which then the other side just says, no, we're not going to do that. And oftentimes they're lying. But Republicans are like, we're not going to take away your healthcare. We're not going to get rid of the provisions on pre-existing conditions. And so what you have is this thing where Democrats are talking about something that the country's not talking about. So to me, the genius of Republican politics is they just sort of go with what the conversation is. So Trump's law and order message, well, he didn't come into 2020 saying my message is going to be law and order. He said, oh, there's all these, you know, progressive protests going on, Black Lives Matter protests. So law and order is going to be my message. And, you know, we thought that that wasn't resonating at all. And it wasn't resonating in the suburbs, it turned out, but it was resonating, it looks like, in rural areas. So, you know, Trump pivoted his message based on what people were talking about. And Democrats, I think, and this ties back to impeachment, this ties back to the Russia investigation, had this huge opportunity, I think, over the last 4 years to make this about how the Republican Party is the corrupt party. That look at Donald Trump, and this is all about corruption. This is about a guy that is putting his interests before your interests. What is Russia collusion? He's even willing to, you know, work with Vladimir Putin behind, you know, and betray the United States. That's a form of corruption. Ukraine, a form of corruption. I think there was a strong corruption message that also would play with the news. So anytime the news is on, you have a message. And Democrats just never had a message, a political message for Russia, for Ukraine. So when I think back on the last 4 years, you know, what I got wrong was assuming that Trump was in this sort of doom loop, which, if people who follow me on Twitter, I kept on tweeting about, that basically he was going to bring the whole Republican Party down, and that senators that had voted for impeachment or voted against impeachment, when you look at Joni Ernst in Iowa, Susan Collins in Maine, that impeachment was going to doom them because it suddenly made their brand, which was about how they're center-right Republicans that can work with both sides of the aisle, it tarnished that and made them just Trumpian Republicans. It turned out that being a Trumpian Republican in Iowa was the pathway to victory. And in Maine, Collins was able, you know, to get a lot of Trump support. You know, Trump won the second congressional district. And win a lot of crossover vote. So impeachment didn't doom senators the way I had expected. And I think in part because Democrats didn't really hammer it home and didn't make impeachment or corruption a major issue in this election.
And we're in the middle of Black Lives Matters, George Floyd, COVID, global economic collapse. Impeachment wasn't going to play.
No, but I think corruption could have played. But this is all what this is Monday morning quarterbacking. The Biden campaign, it's basically the same message that Democrats have been running for the last four cycles. And Democrats know that that can get a majority of the vote, particularly if, you know, you have someone with high favorability ratings and a motivated base. And that turned out to be right. The alternative was choosing another path, another route that may, I think, in retrospect, have led to more success down ballot, but would have been riskier. So if you'd gone with Elizabeth Warren more populist or Bernie Sanders more populist economic message, if you've really gone with a corruption message, you know, maybe that takes you away from the thing that is getting you to win suburban voters. So, you know, I think where this leaves, though, the Democratic Party in American politics is not in a great place where it looks like Democrats can really win on the national level consistently. You know, every election, Democrats are winning the popular vote by not small margins. But then, you know, the country is built in such a way that its politics are skewered, and the Senate is not reflective of the national vote total. It's reflective mainly of, you know, disproportionately of rural areas. And so I think there's now probably time to try out a different message. And Democrats never really defined Trump. There was never a clear message about why Trump was bad for you, the American citizen. It was all sorts of things about how, you know, how much of a mess, how corrupt, how incompetent, how tired, how bad of a role model. But there's a large part of the country that just wants to burn down American politics. And Trump has that lasting appeal and turned out a record number of voters for him. So at the end of the day, Trump got a record amount of votes. But I think when you look at how close this election, what it means is not that nothing mattered. It's not that, you know, all the scandals didn't matter. Didn't mean that the Russia investigation didn't matter. It didn't mean that impeachment didn't matter. It means that it mattered. That American politics is a sort of this cumulative effort of things that then results in sort of one vote, you know, after a long period of time, after 4 years. To me, I think everything mattered. I think the fact that Trump's administration was rightly consumed by scandal, by impeachment, by the Russia investigation, because these were unfathomable scandals, meant that he was never popular, meant that his approval ratings were always low, meant that large swaths of the of you know, basically conservative suburban America turned against him. I think meant that everything mattered. And so at the end of the day, this election was decided by the work that I think everybody did, whether it was the work that the Biden campaign did, which deserves a ton of credit in getting this and in defeating Donald Trump, but also the work of the reporters that were covering the Russia investigation. I think the work that we did here on The Asset in covering the Russia investigation, covering the Russia scandal, covering impeachment, the attention paid there really mattered. And so, you know, while I think there's different points of emphasis that could have been done throughout the election, throughout the last 9 months, and Democrats could have done some things differently. Republicans definitely could have done a lot of things differently. I think at the end of the day, it all mattered, and the country ultimately rejected Donald Trump. That's what elections are for, and he ultimately lost, and in the national vote, lost quite convincingly.
You say he lost. He disagrees with you. And there are two world leaders that have not yet congratulated Joe Biden on his presidential victory, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump.
And after that, you see suddenly this host of, you know, legal energy. While it looked like Trump was sort of exhausted by the long counting and the fact that he was definitely going to lose. I'm not saying there's a connection there. I'm just saying that I think this was Donald Trump's play in 2016 as well. That, you know, he's a loser who loses all the time in his business life, right? We, you know, go back and listen to episode 2, episode 3, episode 4 of season 1, and you see a guy who again and again in his business life says, look at this great new tower I'm building, and then a year later goes bankrupt and he's getting sued and there's all these lawsuits. And it's always about someone else's fault. And Trump, you know, oftentimes pulls the ripcord and jumps away, declares bankruptcy. And so I think this is part of this is that Donald Trump doesn't care about American democracy. I think you could argue from a conspiracy theorist, you know, probably if you were a conspiracy theorist, say, well, maybe Putin put him up to this. I just think Trump, this is Trump's way out of saying that he was robbed. And it's much easier for a loser, a sore loser, to always say, someone else really, I really won, but it was just this other, this, you know, all this stuff that happened. And so I think this is his way out. And it's not going to work. You know, while it did come down to 45,000 votes, the good thing that Biden was able to do was expand the map. You know, there's a combination of states that put Biden over to get him to 306. So, you know, I think what it shows you, though, is that if this came down to one state, this came down to a Florida-like scenario, or if this had just come down to Pennsylvania, our democracy would have been in a world of hurt. Instead, you know, this is a coup by buffoons, and it's not going to work. And I think a lot of it has to be seen in the context of Trump wanting to stay politically relevant, wanting to sort of mobilize his base, wanting to sort of have some control over the Republican Party going forward. And why is that? Because he's going to be in a lot of legal jeopardy. He's going to be in a really tough shape after he leaves office. The New York state attorneys are looking at his businesses. the fact that his taxes have now are in their hands. I think they're looking at real charges. Ivanka Trump tweeted that, you know, the other day that this is real harassment, that there's these investigations going on. Rudy Giuliani looks like he's being investigated by the Southern District of New York. And, you know, you have things sitting out there, for instance, like the whole volume two of the Mueller report, which shows that Trump obstructed justice. He can be charged for that. Remember, Mueller said he's not the prosecutor. So some other federal prosecutor can charge him. And so I think he's really nervous about his legal jeopardy. He needs to stay a political actor that therefore can tap into his legion of followers that can then put political pressure on the Biden administration, on Republicans, to decry any efforts to prosecute him. So I think this is sort of the, you know, he's trying to maintain his leverage over the Republican Party. He's trying to activate his supporters. He's trying to delegitimize the Biden administration, which I think is something that Vladimir Putin would definitely want. And that's what Vladimir Putin was trying to do in 2016, was delegitimize the Hillary Clinton administration through Trump claiming voter fraud. So I think all of that is at play, all sorts of reasons for him to do it. It's not going to work at all. I think there is an ongoing question going forward, though, about how eager U.S. officials, both in the Biden administration, both at the state level, are going to be to hold him legally accountable. And I think there's going to be a lot of internal discussions about what should be done here and what I think Biden has done the right thing in saying it's not up to him to determine whether people are prosecuted. We have a set, you know, that is up to the Department of Justice. That is up to prosecutors. He doesn't determine that. And that shouldn't be where the president gets involved in directing prosecutions. So he has drawn a real bright line there. However, you do send signals about to prosecutors about what you're sort of, you know, what can help get a prosecutor ahead in a bureaucracy when you, if you say that, I don't know if we want to prosecute this guy, I don't know if it's appropriate, that does send a signal and decreases the appetite perhaps of a federal prosecutor from taking on such a politically charged case. So, you know, I think that's one of the main uncertainties going forward in 2021. I think there's an argument to just turn the page and we just want to focus on other things. However, you know, the rule of law is the rule of law, and these guys have broken the law again and again and again. And if there's no accountability here, how is there going to be any accountability going forward? So I expect, at least at the state level, that Trump is super nervous, and the Trump organization, I think, is going to be in real trouble as a money making, not that it ever really made money, but it may be as a money laundering operation, is going to have real trouble going forward.
It should also be noted that, you know, any sort of federal pardon, whether that would stand or not, you know, of the president pardoning himself, wouldn't apply to state charges, state investigations.
Right.
So, the real jeopardy he faces is at the state level.
Yeah.
State crimes are not covered by federal pardons.
And it wouldn't shock me also if after the vote is certified, after, I think it's December 14th, and then in early January, there's various steps that we never really had to pay attention to before in terms of the transition, perhaps since 2000, that I think it is possible in early January, after it's like confirmed and the Biden administration is going to be coming in, that Trump does resign, Pence becomes president and sort of is instructed to pardon Trump. Because I think there is also a lot of federal criminal exposure. And so while the state crimes can't be pardoned away, and it's unclear whether you could, you know, there is a different legal interpretation that some have that a corrupt pardon, that, you know, basically if Trump were to get pardoned, and it's basically because he knows crimes are coming, that there's a way that corrupt pardon can't be done, because that in itself might be an illegal act, in a sort of a form of bribery. But I think, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that in the final weeks of the Trump administration, that Trump pulls the ripcord and suddenly it's up to Pence, who's now president, to pardon Trump. And, it sounds crazy, but there's a lot of time left and crazy things happen every week in the Trump world.
What are you saying about Mike Pence's character when you're hypothesized that he might pardon Donald Trump?
Well, I think this is the thing that Trump has demonstrated in this election, that there's no post-Trump Republican Party. And this is, the thing that is really demoralizing for a lot of the kind of Lincoln Project Republicans, is that they expected a massive defeat, but Trump, you know, turned out a record number of voters. And so Trump is going to be this important political figure. So if you're Mike Pence and are thinking about running in 4 years, or anyone, or Mark Pompeo, then you got to kind of hold the Trumpian line. And so that gives Trump a lot of leverage over these Republican politicians going forward. And, you know, while Mike Pence might not want his sort of final act in office to be pardoning Donald Trump, my guess is he would do it if asked, because Trump would sick his supporters on him if he didn't. And that would be the end of his career. The one thing I'll say, maybe as we close, is I do think the Republican Party has a lot of problems too, right? There, you look at a lot of Republican consultants and they're trying to claim, look, you know, we're the working class party now. We can set up the, you know, if we just had sort of another populist politician that wasn't Trump, but that was sort of a more polished politician that was slightly less racist and did less crazy things and just was a better politician, we could win. And they, you know, point to someone like Josh Hawley, who's the up and coming senator from Missouri, or Tom Cotton. And I think the problem that they're going to have is that Trump is the anti-politician. He's anti-politics. His appeal is that he wants to burn it down. And when you look at someone like Hawley or Tom Cotton, and they, you know, went to the fancy schools and are clearly look like politicians, I just think they're going to be, it's going to be hard for them to be Trumpian, to claim that same enthusiasm that Trump was able to turn out white voters that never, people who never voted before. I don't know if those people are going to turn out for people who look like they're just normal politicians. So I think they're going to have a real problem in a post-Trump era if that does happen, if Trump doesn't run in 4 years, or another Trump doesn't run in 4 years, or in 2 years in a House election, on trying to recreate the kind of Trumpian enthusiasm, because they look like normal politicians.
All right, Max, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Woody. And also, I just want to thank all the Asset listeners. Doing this series has been a tremendous honor and privilege. It's been a ton of work, but it's been so richly rewarding. And especially all the feedback that we've gotten, all the positive feedback and some negative feedback, but mostly positive feedback about the show. And you know, please still recommend the podcast out to people. So when Donald Trump says or does something crazy that involves anything involving the things that we talk about, we'll be back.
We can pass this chapter and say, oh, that was an aberration. I'm not willing to take that risk. Regardless of who the next president is, I'd want these institutional reforms. So for whoever comes a decade from now or whenever, at the end of the day, who would test the limits of presidential powers, who believes in this unitary theory of I am the state, I am the personification of what the law and the government is, well, that has to be protected against. And we've seen that as well framed as our constitutional order has been, it has challenges, and we need to be able to also deal with those challenges to preserve the union.